Good afternoon. Welcome to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. Today I'm honored to have as my guest Romulus Linney, one of America's greatest playwrights. And this is the first playwright that I'll be talking with on the show. And we'll be talking today, I'm delighted to say, that last night I heard Mr. Linney read his adaptation of Tim O'Brien's National Book Award-winning novel, Going After Cacciato. So serendipity intervened, and so I'll be talking to Mr. Linney this morning about Going After Cacciato. And one of the things that I would like to discuss is the genesis of the play, the adaptation, the production, and then once the production has been done, how local theaters can participate in the production. So, Mr. Linney, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Casey. How are you? Good to see you.
Going After Cacciato has been attempted many, many times, primarily in film, and this must have been quite an undertaking to attempt to do the adaptation that you did of the novel because of the nature of the fantasy and the reality.
Well, my faith in Tim O'Brien and my knowledge of the novel, because I had read it some time ago, and the fact that I have adapted novels, I've written three novels myself, so I like very much to have that kind of density and weight in a play, if you could make it theatrical, which is difficulty, but a small theater company, Epic Theater Company, in New York, just called me out of the blue, and they didn't know that I knew Tim, and they just said, "Would you like to adapt Going After Cacciato?" And I said, "Well, yes, if Tim would." Yeah. And they said yes. So Tim and I, our agents, made a deal. So I read the book, and the book is extremely complicated in the way Tim unfolds it. You feel a novelist's great creative powers moving and taking things from all over the place and blending them and putting them together. And as you say, there is a fantasy level to this. The only war novel I know of that has this element as a central element. I mean, the soldiers that have, you know, dreams and visions, but this is very central to it. So I talked to Tim, and Tim, as you know, was right in the middle of the Vietnam War and is the preeminent Vietnam novelist of the United States. I was a little earlier, but I did my 2 years in garrison duty at Schofield Barracks in Hawaii, and so I know the Army of my time. And that's sort of basic, you know the basic way men are in the Army, not under the stress of war as Tim did, but the basic thing about being in the Army. So I read the book and read the book and read the book, and then I did something interesting, which was that I got another copy of the book, and I cut it up so that the two elements of the book, the fantasy element of it and the real element of it, I could separate apart from the way Tim had done it. And so searching for a solid dramatic construction that would make a play, which is very different than a novel and so on. So I did that. And that was fine. It wasn't hard. Once I got that in my mind, once I got the construction, that I wanted to do, I was okay. And I did it in, a little while. I have a theory about adapting novels or poems or whatever, anything from literature into a play, and that is that it's either a marriage or a love affair. Mm-hmm. If it's a marriage, like Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying, I mean, if it's A Lesson Before Dying, it's a marriage, and you're very faithful, you know, and yes. you don't mess around. I used almost all Ernie's dialogue in that work and stuck very closely. I had to make some dramatic decisions about combining characters and how to construct it so it takes place in front of an audience, live audience, all of that. But the language is very much Ernie's. With Going After Cacciato, it's a love affair. In other words, you're so stimulated by the book that once you find one essential structure that you're going to stick to, and our friend Somerset Maugham said, you know, writing plays, stick to the point and cut when you can. So once I did that, then I was sort of free to put in some stuff of my own about the Army, which when I did the draft, I sent it down to Tim, and that was fine with him.
Good.
So we I got a draft. and sent it out, and the theater that commissioned it, the small theater commissioned this, so they gave us the money. So they have the option on it, and they're trying to get it done this year. And but I came up here to Suwannee, and you give these readings up here, and I enjoyed doing that. I used to be an actor, and I enjoy doing that. And I sat down, and I realized that in this draft, which was maybe about the second draft by that time, I had leaned too much on Tim, and I had, you know, there was a lot in there that I hadn't quite done my work, so I hadn't quite crystallized it and cut it down and quite gotten it so that it was quite as actable as it should be. We had a reading in New York, and it seemed all right, but then I saw that it wasn't, so I spent the last week, you know, sweating a little bit and working on it and doing some cuts and tightening it and doing all that stuff that you do later in a draft, not in the first draft, but later on. And then, so we read it last night, and it seemed to be all right.
Yes, I think I mentioned earlier, I used the term tour de force, and I think that how many total characters in the play are
about
there?
Eight.
About eight. And you read it last night, reading all eight voices, and I was, as I was listening, I was trying to imagine a theater with a stage with eight different people reading it, and if it's anything like hearing you read the eight characters, it's going to be very powerful with
well, it's a very powerful book. I mean, good night. I had to exclude a great deal of it, but I think, find the basic structure of it and what is certainly pertinent today. So it's a very powerful book.
Yes, it is. We're going to take a short break here. This is the Casey Coar Show, A Celebration of Words. We're joined today by Romulus Lenny. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to the Casey Coar Show. We're joined today by Romulus Lenny. And right now we're talking about going after Cacciato, his adaptation of the Tim O'Brien novel. And he just explained to us the process that he went through adapting the work. And now I've asked him to educate us a bit on how local theaters and regional theaters and major theaters go about acquiring the play and producing the play once it has been performed by the company that has commissioned the work.
Well, a play goes from playwright to agent to producers. Whether those producers be individuals, which is not so usual these days, or theaters, which is much more likely. Resident theaters, small theaters in New York, off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway, and the few producers that still produce on Broadway, though they Elizabeth McCann and who else, you know. So what you do is, I mean, this play was commissioned from us, and so the Epic Theater Company, which is a small young theater in New York, still has the option on it for the rest of this year, but they are also sending it out, maybe hoping for a co-production with a good resident theater, something like that. So in other words, you send your play out, and you try to find a theater that wants to produce it. And once they do, and you say, okay, then your agent works out a contract, and the way you go. Then if the play is produced, say at the Actors Theatre of Louisville, or at the Mark Taper Forum in California, or at the Milwaukee Repertory, or the Alley Theatre, or something like that, then it can be published by the companies that publish play scripts, Samuel French or Dramatists Play Service, with which I'm affiliated. And at that point, it goes into the catalogs, so, and is sold as a play script, like the one I'm looking at right over there. And that's the way that people who are looking for plays to produce in their theaters find plays. Also, of course, you can have your plays published in a trade publication. Smith and Krause is a company that publishes a great many playwrights, and TCG publishes playwrights, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
So that's about it, you know. Then the other thing is that you, as the playwright, need to scramble. Your agent, after all, can only do so much. And if you sit back and wait for your agent to do everything, if you're a playwright, especially if you're I know even very famous playwrights who do their own. You know, they don't just leave it up to agents. So it's very much a scramble.
So the best thing to do is to, as I'm looking at from Dramatists Play Service, is to get a copy of the publication of the play, read it, and then if it's something that you're very interested in, follow your heart in terms of...
Well, you just get the rights from them. Because then Dramatists Place, Eric Samuel French, they control, they license the play for college productions, for amateur productions, and even for resident theater productions.
Now. Good. Well, thank you for explaining that to us, because it's one of those things I think that a lot of people are interested in and don't really understand how that works.
Of course, you can always get a copy of the manuscript by writing to the playwright if it hasn't been published or if it's or hasn't been quite produced yet, and you find out about it. You can always say, hey, can you send me a script, and get it that way.
You mentioned earlier the adaptation of A Lesson Before Dying, and that's a book that I have a particular love of. And I think that you mentioned Ernest Gaines earlier, and we were both here at the University of the South at the Suwannee Writers Conference. We think it was 1996. And Mr. Gaines stood up and read the first three chapters of A Lesson Before Dying. And it was one of the most powerful moments I've experienced as a listener. And in the opening scene in the novel, which, thank heavens, so many people have read because of the selection by Oprah Winfrey as the book of the month, it's become a novel that is much loved in around the world, and it involves one of the things that I think was so dramatic about that is the line where the defense says this would be like killing a hog. And when I read your adaptation, it seems to me that that something about that phrase really resonated with you as well.
Well, you need in a play, you need a moment in which you unify the audience, in which you say something or something happens on the stage that is very strong, and the audience forgets all about who it is individually and who's sitting next and whether the dinner was digested and whether the date's working out,
right,
how
right.
much money they spent and all of that, and they suddenly all become fixed on the play. When the ghost appears to Hamlet and so on. And The Lesson Before Dying, I thought that was the moment when that suddenly is we know about that. There's an interesting problem with doing A Lesson Before Dying. I had known Ernest as my friend for a long time. We were on the NEA panel together in 1976, and I have always thought the world of him and loved his books. And when that book was published, I read it and I wrote to him and I said, Ernie, this is built like a play. Time went by, and the movie rights and the drama rights were sold, and then they lapsed. And then the drama rights went to the Alabama Shakespeare Festival, and then the movie rights were somewhere else. And I got to do the dramatization. And the interesting thing was that in a movie you could do it fine, because in the first scene you see the robbery.
Yes.
And you know that Jefferson, the young black man who was on trial for his life, did not do this. In the play, however, that scene, you can't just jump all around, you know. So the play begins in the prison when the step-grandmother, whatever Miss Emma is,
yes,
comes to see him and bring the teacher in to try to help him. The first time you see Jefferson, he's brought in chains, and you just see a man in chains. Well, the audience doesn't know whether he killed anybody or not, and so forth. So we did readings of it, and it just was not, you know, working. And finally, a wonderful guy named Ricardo Kahn, who ran the Crossroads Theater, which is an African-American theater in New Brunswick, New Jersey, did a reading, and he found the absolute perfect guy named Jamal Marsh, who did a wonderful job in this play, both in Montgomery, Alabama, is where the Alabama Shakespeare Festival is, and in New York when we did it. And Jamal walked on the stage, and the minute you looked at him, you knew he couldn't kill anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that really was a key to making this play work. And the production in Montgomery at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival was just fine. And then the production in New York was just fine, and people do it now all around.
That's
a lot of places do a thing where they have people read the book and then see the play.
Oh, that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Columbus Dispatch picked that as the community book of the year. I believe it was in the year 2001, I think it was, and all the branches read it, and then we had a discussion at the library, and it was the people, you can just see their reaction to the power of the novel. And when I read the play, I had the sense that I had when I read the novel. In fact, we were talking the other night, and I told you that I thought you had changed one little detail of the novel when Vivian goes to see
she goes to the prison
to the prison, and I said to you, I said Romulus, I said I thought it was brilliant, and I loved it. I said, all I could see was that you changed one thing, that Vivian goes to see Jefferson in the jail. And you laughed and you said, and tell me what you said.
Well, I said, actually, I didn't change it, that was there. It's inside the boy's notebook when he writes stuff. And I had missed that myself and had not in the first draft put that in there. And I, of course, sent the drafts to Ernie, and we worked, you know, I pay a lot of attention to what Ernie says. And he said, well, why don't you have him? And I said, geez, I missed that. And so we went back and did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it works very well.
Yeah, and I think that it's I'm glad that is brought out in the play, because it really is a very powerful moment.
It's a wonderful moment.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know how many times I've read the novel, but it's like one of those things, you miss something, and, and it's like, you know, you write something and you read it so many times you can't even remember it yourself.
Well, the nice thing about it is that you see her in her everyday clothes, and when she comes to the prison, she puts on the nicest dress she has, and she looks lovely. And she comes in, and she's very cheerful. She doesn't stay long, and she kisses.
Yes.
This guy's the first time any woman has ever kissed him. Mm-hmm. And he's just, you know, this is the beginning of the long process that the school teacher goes through in trying to do the impossible thing, which is to make a very wronged man, very, very wronged young man who's going to be killed for something he didn't do, die nobly. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the lawyer had said, well, this is just an ignorant black man, we might as well be electrocuting a hog. And the boy, the young man, in bitterness, of course, says, all right, they call me a hog, I'll die like a hog. They can drag me to the chair and I'll make as big a mess of it as possible. And the whole play is spent with the teacher trying to get him to die, not so much for us, but for himself, so that he can die with self-respect and pride.
And for his aunt, who has spent so much.
Miss Emma, who has been like his mother.
Yes, and when I was talking to Mr. Gaines here, this was prior to the book being selected by Oprah Winfrey, and I remember each evening I would go and I would tell him about what I had read the previous evening, and I told him there's one scene in the book that just brought me to my knees, and that was where the woman who has raised him brings a meal to the jail, and the jailer, one who is kind of sympathetic to Jefferson and one who's doing this strictly because this is what he's been told by the powers to be, he says, I don't know if I can give him the food, and she says, well, if not, would you give it to the other children?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I asked Mr. Gaines about that, and the beautiful simplicity of that sentence, mm-hmm. would you give it to the other children?
Mm-hmm.
Not the convicts, the felons, mm-hmm. but the other
mm-hmm.
children.
Mm-hmm.
And he laughed and he said that one of his aunts used to, did not have a son who was in prison, but used to make a meal on Sunday and take it to the prison to mm-hmm. distribute to the mm-hmm. to the men that were in the prison. And I mean, I don't know how much better you can get than mm-hmm. scenes like that. We're discussing A Lesson Before Dying and Going After Cacciato that have been adapted by Romulus Lenny. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to shift gears a little bit, and I have asked Mr. Lenny to read us a short play that he wrote, and this is in a collection of Mr. Lenny's, which is titled 17 Short Plays. And it's a Smith and Krause book, and it's available in a beautiful trade paperback. And when we come back from a short break, Mr. Lenny has graciously agreed to read this play for us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Casey Kowar Show, A Celebration of Words. You're in for a treat right now. I've asked Romulus Lenny to read a short play called Clair de Lune. And without anything further from me, I'll give you the experience of listening to Mr. Lenny read his work aloud.
Thank you, Casey. Clair de Lune is a short play that is one of six in a collection called Pops, and the idea is to build all these short plays around a piece of popular classical music, and this one is called Clair de Lune. It's dedicated to my friend Lois Lancette. The characters are Abel, a retired Midwestern farmer in his 60s, Lucille, his thoughtful and troubled wife in her 50s, place is a trailer park in Florida, and time is the present. Moonlight. Enter Abel carrying two beers, a small wooden box, and an aluminum plastic beach chair. Abel, come on out. Mother, if I have to hear it again, I want to listen to it out here. Enter Lucille with a second chair and a small tape recorder with a cassette in it. She is looking at the cassette case. All right, Father, I'll play it in the moonlight. She puts down her chair, sits in it, places the tape recorder on a box in front of her. Abel, here's your beer, Mother. Let her rip. Lucille takes the beer, plays the cassette. On the little recorder is played Claire de Lune. Da-dee-dum, ta-da-dum, ta-da-da-dee-dum. They listen. Lucille, that's so pretty. Classics of the night, it says here. That little piece means moonlight, it says here. Who'd ever think a body could get so much pleasure out of one little tune? Abel takes a fishing reel out of his pocket. Well, Mother, I hope you do. You play it enough. It suddenly gets darker. Abel, whoop, there goes your moon, Mother, right behind the cloud. Oh, fish, it was so pretty, shining on a lake like the music. Well, Abel, thought we'd get a look at the camp swans. You beautiful critters, swans in the moonlight. They're mean, though. All took up with their selves. They hiss at you, peck you, can't tolerate nobody else but themselves. Swans in the moonlight. The pleasures of Florida. Abel, yep, beer, trailer, swans. Retirement, Father. That's it, Mother, retirement. He looks at his reel. Claire de Lune plays. Da-dee-dum, da-da-dum. Ta-dee-da-da-dum. Lucille, Father. Yes, Mother. We do right coming here. I think we did. We could have farmed another 2 years, maybe more, but we didn't. I know we didn't, and I know I said, yes, all right, let's go, but now I just don't know. Don't know what, Mother, if we should have come here. The sec Claire de Lune ends, fading away, replaced by Strauss Waltz. Lucille turns off the recorder, rewinds the cassette. I just don't know. Hey, well, yes, you do. You know what's wrong. Say it. I miss my children. Do you? Yes, I do. Uh-huh. But it is peaceful here. I do like that. Abel, yes, so do I. No more phone calls in the middle of the night. Yelling and sobbing and screaming and crying, wedding, divorces, other man's wife, other woman's man, whiskey, dope, and God knows what else, pistols twice, shotgun once, fist through windows, bloody shirts, dresses torn apart, abortions, and car wrecks, eight of them, eight, count them, eight car wrecks. God almighty. Lucille, they were what they were. We got in trouble. Yeah, they got in trouble. Four trips to hell in a county courthouse, half the crop going every other year to goddamn lawyer, all the world shaking its head at our children. We done our best to bring up right. Mother, let them untangle their own lies and leave us to find a little peace in ours. Lucille, but why? That's what I keep wondering about. Our children, why? Abel, we don't know why. Neither does nobody else. Judges, police, doctors, nobody. Children go crazy. We done our best by them, left them half the farm, now to hell with it. We have earned our rest. Yeah, we gave them half the farm, but was that enough? What I keep thinking about, Father, is what we didn't give them, couldn't give them. Well, what's that? Joy? Some real pleasure in life? You know, what we had together, what we always had together. Mother, I don't think anybody can give anybody that. But why not? They ought to. I tried to tell Sarah once what it was like seeing you for the first time, not liking you at all, and then you just waiting for me and waiting for me. Well, I knew, Mother, I just knew. And from the first time, everything, I mean the first time, together, like, well now, well, that Mother, stop fretting about this. But it was good. It was always good. God help us, Father, after all these years. It's good now. I know that. Then why not for them? Not one of them. What is it we have just took for granted they can't never find, no matter how hard they try? Now, Mother, shut up. I will not. I never in my life wanted no man but you. And if what you're always telling me is the truth, it's not truth, Mother. Only time I tried anybody else, I got sick. You know that. Then why? Why? What did we have all them years working and sweating and farming and making do? They couldn't have too. What did we do wrong? Nothing. They did all that. Now hush up. What did God
give us that he kept from them.
It suddenly gets brighter. Now look, Mother, there's your moon again. Play that tune for yourself and settle down. I won't hear this no more.
All right.
She plays Clair de Lune again. Da-dee-dum, ta-da-dum. Ta-dee-da-dee-dum, ta-da-da.
Hey, there, look, by God.
They both point together, staring at the lake.
Lucille Swans, Father. Abel Swans. In the moonlight.
Strange-looking critters, just gliding along.
I don't think I like them so much, says Lucille.
Abel says, 'cause they're mean. They look good, but they're cold, mean inside, all took up with themselves. You come between two swans, you get pecked to death.
Lucille, who'd want to come between them?
Well, I don't know. Somebody.
Lucille, the swan is a beauty easy to take. Two are better upon the lake.
You just make that up?
No.
Read it yesterday. Where? Reader's Digest. Oh. Lucille, it was in some article about zoos. Pause. Lucille turns off the music.
I miss my children.
Abel, yeah. He spins his reel. The moonlight fades. End of play.
Beautiful. Romulus, thank you for reading that. You told me that that play was recently done, and I believe you said Alaska, is that correct?
Yeah, there's a wonderful festival every summer in Valdez, Alaska. It's the Edward Albee Last Frontier Festival. And playwrights and people come from all over the country for almost 10 days. And a great many things are done at night in this lovely theater they have. It's a small a college there run by a fantastically energetic and able President Joanne McDowell, Prince William Sound Community College. And all sorts of great stuff is done there. And they have an honoree playwright every year. This year it was Tony Kushner. Last year it was me. And John Guare was there this year. He's been honorary playwright. And just terrific people. So every night they have excerpts from plays or plays or this, that, and the other. It's quite a nice festival.
And what month does that take place?
In June.
In June. Well, it sounds like for the listeners out there that love the theater that you could combine a nice trip to Alaska with some wonderful theater and have a great time when you're not jumping around on glaciers. You could go see some...
Yeah, well, that's what happens. People go there, and there is time so that they're able to take some trips. There's side trips to go. You can go to the great, wonderful parks and all the beautiful things there are to see in Alaska, which... if you haven't been there, it's spectacular.
Yeah, I was there, I guess it was probably about maybe 12 years ago, and it's quite an experience, just Alaska itself.
It certainly is.
The beauty, and pictures and postcards don't quite do it justice.
No, they don't.
Much like reading some plays versus hearing them read aloud or performed, there's a majesty that perhaps isn't quite as apparent. When you wrote Clair de Lune, do you remember approximately when, how long ago that was?
Oh, yeah, it was a long time ago. I don't know, 15 years ago, maybe even more. And it's interesting, the reason that I wrote that little play is that I come from basically rural people in Appalachian, North Carolina, and various places in Tennessee. And so a lot of my roots and thinking and the novels that I've written have more or less Appalachian backgrounds, two of them of the three. And I read in a paper somewhere, and I'm not sure if this is my imagination, Casey, whether I really read this or not, but evidently according to some poll, it turned out that the people who have the best sex lives are farmers.
Oh. Well,
you know,
there you go. I've never heard that before.
Either I really read that or it's something that my imagination or subconscious played on me, but it makes sense. You're around animals all the time when you're a kid.
And I have some farmers in my lineage, so that makes me feel good.
Well, anyway... that just sort of intrigued me, so I sat down and just sort of had a very, very lovely feeling, a good, quiet, calm feeling, and knew it was going to be just a little play. And I came out rather well. And the they did it up at Valdez in Alaska, and had two marvelous older actors who really did a good job of it, rather better than I've ever seen it. So
oh, that's wonderful. It's, I guess that's the beauty of art, is that you write a piece like that during a call moment, and it is as relevant today as it was the day you wrote it. And
well, I think that's what good theater is. You don't consciously try to do that or anything, but I think that if you are really deeply attracted to something, and very often you don't know why until mm-hmm. much later mm-hmm. or even then, chances are it's a fairly universal thing. And mm-hmm. Time doesn't really do a lot to that. I mean, most of everything that's written, time just demolishes it.
Yes.
But some things are as good. Now, for instance, Tim O'Brien's novel, Going After Cacciato, is even more powerful today
yes.
than it was in 1979. You know, it's so.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I think that is so wonderful about the setting we find ourselves in here at the University of the South. It's a real nicely knit community of people that have an appreciation, I think, of the timeless nature of art. And you're here as the major playwright in the conference. And if you would, I would just like to end the interview with maybe some ideas you have or some thoughts you would like to express to young playwrights who are encountering obstacles and frustrations, and what you tell your students here at Sewanee about the art of playwriting. And I'm glad you mentioned your novels, because I'm delighted to say that they've been reissued.
Mm-hmm. Two of them.
Yeah. Two of them have been reissued in very nice trade paperbacks. Mm-hmm. Who's the publisher?
Shoemaker and Horde.
Shoemaker and Horde. So those are two novels that are currently available again. And Mr. Linney is probably one of the few people I've met who has began his career as a novelist and moved into the playwriting field.
Well, actually, Casey, I really, I began as an actor. I was an actor for a long time.
Okay.
So actually, I was actor to director to novelist to playwright, and I still write stories and things. I don't know mm-hmm. whether I'll ever write another novel or not. I hope so, but
good.
That's the way that worked. It was a peculiar way to evolve, but not unreasonable. I look mm-hmm. back on it.
Yeah. So to the young playwright.
Well, I think that the main thing is that you have to have a great love is a too general a word. Obsession, maybe passion for, or whatever. Bomb Magazine, which is a very good magazine in the Village in New York, has just done an interview. I did an interview with my daughter, the actress Laura Linney, mm-hmm. who now has become very accomplished. And we did an interview, and in it, one of the things that Laura said was that she never, ever allowed herself, as she was working her way through college and Juilliard her early career, she never really allowed herself to worry about where she was going to be or what was going to happen to her or whatever. She took it as it came. And the thing that sustained her all the time was just how much she loved to act. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's exactly the same thing for writing, and especially for writing plays. It is rather more difficult to get a play produced than it is to get a novel published or poems published. Production of a play is a very hard thing to do. So when you're writing the play, you're writing it... You better not think about where it's going to be produced or who's going to do it or what's going to happen to you, because you must, if you're going to write a play that's any good, you have got to be able to give yourself completely to it, and you got to be able not to be discouraged. Mm-hmm. You got to love playwriting so much, and it is, after all, something that's that commands your respect. It's flesh and blood up there facing flesh and blood. It's not a movie. It's not mm-hmm. a bunch of photographs. Mm-hmm. As wonderful as films can be,
right.
Theater is quite different. And it is something that it is quite easy to become attached to and to feel there is no substitute for it ever. Mm-hmm.
Good. When is When was the issue of bomb published with the interview with
it's
your daughter?
It's still come out. I'm not sure when they're going to do it. They publish, I think, 4 or 5 times a year.
Okay.
It's a beautiful magazine. They do interviews with artists, as well as they've published some fiction of mine, and I did another interview with the playwright Donald Margulies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good magazine.
Yeah. Well, listeners, stay tuned to the show, and whenever the magazine is released, I'll inform you of that, and we can all flood Bomb Magazine with subscriptions to read the interview.
Very
with
good idea,
Romulus Lenny and his daughter Laura. So, Romulus, thank you so much for your generous time today and for participating in the program. And I wish you nothing but the best with going after Cacciato.
Thank you, Casey, very much indeed.